Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Marty Jackley is South Dakota's Attorney General. He joins us now live via phone from Pierre. Attorney General Jackley, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
We appreciate you waiting for us. We were carrying President-elect Donald Trump's press conference there. And so thank you, first of all, for sticking around.
Certainly.
All right. Since we're talking a little national politics, I want to ask you about Jeff Sessions. And we've talked about Loretta Lynch before, President Obama's attorney general. Do you have any initial thoughts on Jeff Sessions? Is he someone that you know?
You know, certainly I, along with several other nation attorney generals, were supportive of Senator Sessions. Obviously, the things that I looked for were his background. And I saw, you know, that he was certainly a former United States attorney, a former state attorney general. And so he had the background of, you know, somebody that I think will be respectful of states' rights, respectful that, you know, one of the largest things that the Department of Justice can do is not necessarily fight with state attorney generals, but join us in partnerships to help address some of those important issues like human trafficking, some of the meth and heroin epidemics, some of the data breach issues. And so we're looking forward, to having a long-standing working relationship with the new Department of Justice. And that's not to say, you know, certainly we worked with the, you know, previous administration, the Department of Justice issues, but there were times there was conflict. And oftentimes those conflicts were a matter of philosophy and believing that states' rights and having state attorney generals, you know, do important issues, is a large part of what we do.
Is there anything in particular that you think needs to sort of be undone or readjust, or do you just smoothly transition into the future?
You know, we're going to keep, you know, the state attorney generals are going to keep focused on issues important to our states. You know, my presidential initiative was one of law enforcement officer-involved shootings, methamphetamine. The new president is focused on health care. And so I see us continually doing that and working on, you know, partnerships with the new Department of Justice. And a lot of that we already do here in South Dakota. The human trafficking operations that we run are run with our local chiefs and sheriffs, our, you know, state attorney general and DCI, and our federal partners. And so we're going to keep doing just that here in South Dakota. On a national level, you know, I hope that when you place an attorney general, a state attorney general in charge of the Department of Justice, there will be a natural working on relationships to build partnerships and share resources.
Let's talk about state of South Dakota now. Governor Dennis Dugard gave his State of the State address yesterday. I'm wondering what your department's legislative priorities are. Where do you want to begin?
Sure. You know, I have brought forth early on 6 pieces of legislation, and they're focused on really protecting South Dakota both on a public safety standpoint as well as financially. I mean, certainly one of the biggest pieces of my package is the proposed dealing with conflicts of interest. And what I've attempted to do is basically upfront say a public official is entrusted to take care of taxpayer monies. And if they knowingly and intentionally use that position of trust to steal the taxpayer dollars, there needs to be consequences greater than a simple misdemeanor. And so I brought forth a package that's very narrow. The reason that I made it narrow is we want in South Dakota our citizens to volunteer in elections to run for office. We want our, you know, boards filled, our voluntary boards. So this piece of legislation is really geared at the bad actors, those that aren't making mistakes. They're knowingly and intentionally using that position of trust to take from the taxpayers. And that's a very straightforward piece of legislation. The other piece that has gained some fairly significant attention and actually has its first hearing tomorrow morning at 7:45 a.m. is the releasing of booking photos. Right now, and it surprises the public to learn, and oftentimes the media, that it is a misdemeanor crime for a sheriff to give out a routine booking photo. And I just feel strongly as a matter of government transparency and really to make sure that the media and the public are identifying the right individuals involved in the criminal process, that we should follow what other states do, and that is to allow a routine public booking photo to just be considered a public record and to treat it as such.
Is that a booking photo for any crime, or is it limited to, violent crimes? Or so a DWI photo, for example, is public record?
You know, at this point, I didn't make a distinguishment. I felt that as a matter of transparency that all routine booking photos should be determined to be a public record. And so certainly that might come up during session, may even come up tomorrow morning when it has its first hearing. But we just felt that when you look at where we've come as a state in transparency, that this is a logical next step.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about meth. You mentioned it earlier. And more of an epidemic before? Are we always talking about meth as an epidemic? Do you have legislation that is directly targeted at that?
When you look at meth, it is an epidemic across the nation. Montana got hit with it a little bit earlier than we did, so we're a little late in the game. And the advantage for that is we can look at what other states have done when it comes to addressing meth. And really, it's a three-part plan, and some of it South Dakota heard from the governor yesterday. So when you look at the three-part plan, you know, my position as Attorney General is the most important thing we can do is awareness and awareness with children. So I have the Attorney General's No Meth Ever program going on right now. It's in our colleges. It will be moving into our high schools and helping the youth out. The second stage is what I would call treatment. That's our drug courts. Those are the hope courts, taking those opportunities to address addiction. And then is the third component, and that is addressing the distribution of meth in our state. And the governor focused on that with that partnership between the State Highway Patrol and the DCI, which is under the Attorney General, to throw six additional bodies or resources at addressing, you know, and concentrating on meth distribution in our state. And so we're going in the right direction, but that is very, you know, very important, certainly to me as the Attorney General and our state's attorneys and our sheriffs and chiefs, is to make sure that we've dedicated the resources to address who's bringing in the methamphetamine, and when they do bring it in, and especially when they distribute it to our children, that we hold them accountable.
What are the challenges in a state like South Dakota regarding treatment and sort of that area of focus?
I mean, I think the key problem is availability. When you look at rural South Dakota, sometimes, you know, we lack the treatment facilities that are in the more metropolitan areas, and so it requires travel and other challenges. But those are challenges that can and need to be overcome. And I think the best place is, of course, to start with that awareness. If we can put together a strong awareness campaign, and we are right now with the Attorney General's No Meth Ever, we need to get ahead of it before it gets to the need for treatment or the need for prosecution.
And you and I talked about that before, and you said that really works. And I think I asked you, I mean, does awareness really work? And you were unequivocal about that it does.
It does. I mean, my colleagues, Governor Bullock, who was a Democrat Attorney General, and now Attorney General Tim Fox, who's the Republican Attorney General in Montana, will tell you it has worked tremendously in Montana. Hmm. When you go to heroin and you look at what has happened in areas such as Wisconsin, their awareness plan helped them get ahead of it. And so that's exactly what we need to do here in South Dakota, is really focus on awareness over prosecution. You know, certainly there are those instances when people are bringing it in and distributing it to our children that there needs to be heavy prosecution. But our best dollar spent and to do the right thing is to focus on awareness and then treatment and then prosecution.
Do we have the treatment resources that we need right now to help the people that are suffering today?
We do not. I mean, if you look overall in the state of South Dakota, particularly with juveniles and in other areas, you know, we lack those treatment programs. We're doing better. There's a stronger focus. There's more work being done on it. But, you know, as you ask the question, as of right now, we lack the necessary treatment facilities here in South Dakota to address the number of individuals that need that treatment.
A really aggressive awareness program, an effective awareness program. How long before you start seeing the results of that?
You know, I think you should start seeing it now. I mean, we're in the colleges right now. I had dedicated $35,000 of drug control fund monies to go to essentially educational scholarship awards for them for the college students to study and develop what the No Meth Ever plan will look like in the high schools and probably in our middle schools. And so it's going on college campuses right now. And so I would say we're already on our way with the No Meth Ever campaign, that we're going to start seeing differences here in South Dakota.
One more question about meth, and that's the distribution. What are the challenges in this state of sort of tackling distribution and prosecuting it?
You know, one of the biggest challenges of distribution is it's coming from, you know, our southern borders. And so oftentimes, as a prosecutor, you'll have a large shipment of meth, and sometimes it's heroin, where there's a mule or there's individuals that simply don't know enough information about that shipment of drugs for us to necessarily go up the chain and get the kingpin. And so, you know, obviously, as time has gone on, the drug dealers have found ways to protect themselves, to stay out of our jurisdictions. That's one of the reasons that in my leadership role, as you know, in the nation's attorney generals, we built strong relationships with our state attorney general counterparts in Mexico. And actually, the Conference of Western Attorney Generals has an agreement, not the federal government, but the state attorney generals just simply felt that Congress and the Department of Justice was not doing what it needed to do. So we stepped in, built relationships and agreements, and so we are able to better attack that distribution line on the southern borders and with Mexico based upon working with Mexican prosecutors. And so I think you're going to start continually hearing more about that, seeing more happening with that, and those are good things.
Does a new president in Donald Trump alter that picture at all with your relationship with attorneys general in Mexico?
You know, it certainly could. It certainly should. But we attorney generals have simply, and in a lot of different areas, have said where Congress has simply failed to act to protect our citizens, we are going to. And that's why I think you've seen state attorney generals move forward in a lot of different directions. And it's frankly why you see the President of the United States tapping attorney generals such as Scott Pruitt, to, you know, the attorney general from Oklahoma, to lead the EPA. And so I think you're going to still see the nation's attorney general saying, we'll partner with you, but we feel that these things need to be done, and we're situated to get them done.
An attorney general leading the EPA. Help me figure out the significance of that.
You know, I think part of the significance is having somebody that understands the importance of states' rights. When you look here in South Dakota, and I can say this as a former United States attorney and the attorney general, the number one way that the environment is protected is from private landowners. And when there are those instances when a private landowner isn't being a proper steward of the land or the water, it's the state DENR that actually does the work along with the attorney general on the enforcement. We rarely see instances when the EPA has done anything productive in South Dakota, and I feel strongly that having somebody that understands that, that understands there's a role to partner with the states when you do have those bad actors, you know, two of the largest things happening in South Dakota don't get a lot of media attention are that Waters of the United States, where the EPA has attempted to literally take over all of our waters and our economic development. And the Attorney General stepped up and stopped it, and Scott Pruitt was a strong leader in that. Similarly, with the national energy tax, that was going to have a dramatic effect on our rates and our reliability every time you flip on a light switch here in South Dakota. Again, the attorney generals, and Scott Pruitt was a part of our group, stopped that. It wasn't Congress, it was the attorney generals. And so having one of us that understands those issues and understands an appreciation for landowner rights as well as the importance of state DNRs and state attorney generals in protecting the environment is a good person to put in charge.
Let's talk about the cell phone I'm calling it cell phone tapping. That's not the right word, probably. And bringing that legislation up to date with modern technology. Fill us in on that.
You know, it's very simple. It's something that the governor is bringing. It basically says that the use of technology such as cell phones will be included within the existing laws. I mean, I think the reality is many people across our state now don't use landlines, that there's a heavy reliance upon cell phones, and it still requires all of the proper showings of probable cause and evidence of drug dealing or whatever is trying to be looked into. The protections are there. So all it does is upgrade existing law. Instead of just allowing a process for landlines, I use an example, it will allow a process for cell phones.
And how does that work with text messages and social media? Certainly people who are your bad actors, as you call them, could be using Snapchat to have those conversations as well. What are we looking at in that regard?
Well, oftentimes the limitations aren't necessarily the law, they're technology. And I think South Dakota saw a little bit of that in the Gear Up investigation when, you know, you only have an ability to go back as far as some of the third-party Verizon and other folks keep information. And so some of those challenges that you talk about for law enforcement in our investigations really aren't, the law doesn't get in the way of it, it's just the practicality of You have a sheer volume of text messages and other things. Some carriers keep text messages only for 5 days. And I ran into that in the Turnquist murder case that I tried out in Rapid City, where certainly the providers would have been more than willing to give us that information, but it had just simply been deleted. And so a lot of the challenges when it comes to technology and text messages and Snapchats, it's a function not of the law needing to change, but how long you keep that information.
So what do we as consumers and cell phone owners need to understand? Obviously, we need to understand not to commit a crime. And I understand there's a legal process to getting a search warrant or going through a judge. But do we need to understand anything just as general consumers about how to use our cell phones as it connects with the greater world at this point?
You know, I think, and it's the same thing I tell my 12-year-old son when it comes to Snapchats and everything, you know, be careful when you use that technology, because oftentimes, you know, we are able to go back in if it's something we need to and perhaps be able to accomplish obtaining that information. But as a matter of safety, be careful what you Snapchat, be careful on Facebook what you post, particularly when it's with children, because oftentimes the bad guys are out there looking for that in, and they may use Facebook or other, you know, social medias to, you know, gain information regarding a child or to gain contact with a child. And so I think the biggest thing we need to know about when it comes to technology and Snapchat and cell phones and Facebook and social media is, especially if you're a parent or a grandparent, do the best you can to be aware of what your kids are up to protect them.
My guest is Attorney General, South Dakota's Attorney General, Marty Jackley. Attorney General Jackley, thank you so much for sticking around a little bit late after the press conference. We really do appreciate your time today.
You bet.
Coming up after the break, we sit down with South Dakota Secretary of Veterans Affairs. That's Larry Zimmerman, and he's up next. Stay with us in the moment. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Larry Zimmerman, is with us now. We're following up on the governor's State of the State address. Larry Zimmerman, welcome back to In the Moment.
It's great to be back with you, Lori.
Or maybe welcome to In the Moment for the first time. You've been on, it's a new show. It's a brand new year.
Well, last time I talked to you, I was sitting near Bear Butte out in the middle of the country, and I'm in my office in Pierre, looking forward to a great legislative year.
Excellent. Well, welcome and thank you for your time. We were listening earlier this morning to President-elect Donald Trump, and he made a pretty big announcement about his choice for Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin. General Davis, do you know him? Was that a name that was familiar to you?
The name was not. I am going to do what many veterans are going to do, Google him, find out what's going on, and learn his history. I did listen to President-elect Trump's announcement on it.
Yes, and so give me an idea of what difference that makes, that choice makes. We don't know much about him yet, neither do I, so we'll stay off that. But I'm just wondering, how important is that selection to South Dakota veterans?
Well, I think the position of Veterans Secretary for the federal side and the whole Veterans Administration is important to all of our veterans. You know, we've had the Hot Springs issue in this state, which has gone on for many years and may have an answer to that. But the veterans care and what we receive here, the amounts of money in the budgets for our two veterans hospitals in Sioux Falls and Fort Meade and even the third one in Hot Springs, makes a vast difference on who's running the organization. Different programs that come out, we've had Veterans Choice and many other programs, and how they're managed by that secretary and handed down to his VA directors in our state can affect us tremendously. I'm hoping, as President-elect Trump says, he wants to take care of veterans, that all of that is in a positive mode.
And President-elect Donald Trump certainly was forceful is maybe not the right word, but he made a mention of how important veterans care was and that he wasn't satisfied with the level that it has received in this country. Do you agree with him that we're nationwide not doing as good a job as we really could or should with our veterans care?
You know, I would agree with your key word in there, nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
I would caveat that with our South Dakota veterans and our three VA facilities and the community-based outpatient clinics do an outstanding job with our veterans and look at every way of caring for them in the best possible way.
What are some of the challenges and opportunities in South Dakota? Let's bring it into the state and just talk about that now. Challenges and opportunities in this state of really giving veterans the best care and access to benefits that we can.
The challenges would be geography, and that being our distances from hospitals. And then I'd have to move to number two, and a high on that list would be our reservations and our veteran populations on them. And then, Lori, and you know, you live here. I work with the tribal service officers for our nine tribes across the state. Transportation, monetary issues, the care that's available right there, all of that affects how those veterans are taken care of. So I think geography, our makeup on our tribal reservations, and then, you know, I think our population of veterans as a whole are taken care of. So that opportunity to serve them is there because we do have Fort Meade on the west side with Hot Springs, Sioux Falls on the east side, and then seven or eight community-based outpatient clinics. That's the opportunities. There is the care there. It's getting the veteran to that location for the care that might be the challenge.
Are there creative solutions to that? Like, how are we solving that problem now?
Well, you know, we have transportation folks that do move people around, and when I say people, veterans. The DAV has a program that's nationally used. We also have River City Transportation and Prairie Hills Transportation. And then the VA itself has transportation employees and vehicles that can move your veteran. I tell and would say to any veteran in this state, if you need a ride to a medical appointment or a VA, you can get that. But we need that 24 to 48 hours and then use any one of those available. DAV has vans all over the state. They don't have the lift capabilities for the paralyzed or wheelchair veterans, but the River City and Prairie Hills do, and then the VA itself has transportation coordinators on each side of the state.
Governor Dennis Dugard, in his State of the State address, mentioned some land exchanges and talked about Hot Springs and the veterans' home there, the Michael J. Fitzmaurice Home for Veterans. And I didn't get the whole context there, and I'm wondering if you could catch us up on that.
Well, you know, we took down a building a few years ago to make way for the new facility. So that's a building that had been demolished. And then we took down the second building. That was building four. The second building was building three, where our domiciliary and the couples and the special care unit was. All is now in the new facility. Now what we're doing is we have 100-plus acres there. We still have a three-story facility. It used to be the men's dorm, I'll call it, where I've got some other department folks from across the state that used the main floor of that facility. But we took the cabinet, as we did to Yankton and Redfield in the past years. The last cabinet retreat, if you will, was held at the Hot Springs facility, Michael J. Fitzmaurice Veterans Home, and just looked at, do we need all of the acreage? Do we need each and every one of these buildings? Is there multi-use, city use, other governmental agency use, and something that doesn't be a burden to the taxpayers of the state in cost of maintenance? So we're looking at that and in different ways.
Can you give us an idea of other legislative priorities that you might have this session? You said you were looking forward to a great session. How come?
Well, the reason is, I have a governor's veterans commission that has appointees from the governor that my department uses as a source. But there's also a Veterans Council. And if I could, Lori, that's made up of the American Legion, VFW, Military Order of the Purple Heart, Vietnam Veterans of America, Paralyzed Veterans of America, and Disabled American Veterans. A commander, an adjutant, and a voting member from each one of those organizations makes that council up. I use them as representatives of each of those organizations, and a majority of our veterans across the state, and plan and work with them quarterly. And they've come up with two great things they are pursuing as a Veterans Council. And I back, rather than taking each individual organization and many things they may want, use the priorities of that council, what they want to do. And so I'm working with them very closely. We've grown over the 4 years, and this year looking at two main items that they want to look at with our legislators.
Tell us one of those items, what we might have to look forward to. We've just got about a minute left.
Well, the one would be, I'm going to say veteran. They wanted an Eastside veteran home, but we've done the studies, worked it out, and we're looking with the VA and the CEOs of all of the nursing care companies throughout the state at certifying some beds in the eastern part of the state to give those veterans an opportunity for a bed and a place to be. It's exciting stuff, and we'll have more as we go on in this legislative year.
We look forward to hearing more about that. South Dakota Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Larry Zimmerman, I want to say thank you so much for your time. We look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for your service, veterans, and you, Lori.
And
I
you
know
as,
you served as a Marine.
You as well, sir. Thanks again.
Yeah.
And now we continue our conversations with the freshman class of the South Dakota State Legislature. This time we have Nancy York. She represents District 5. She's from Watertown. Take a listen.
After spending 17 years on the City Council here in Watertown, I was out there for many things during the session and several meetings off and on during the course of the year, too. So I'm familiar with the Capitol. I'm familiar with the procedure, but very new to the whole thing, yes. Mm-hmm.
So give me an idea of why you stepped from local government into state government.
Okay, well, I went off to City Council a couple of years ago, and at that time I thought, you know, I'd really like to go a little step further. Well, then I got a new job, and so I was sort of involved with that, and this year just seemed like a very opportune time because we had openings, we had people that weren't going back to peer. It was a good opportunity. The Republican Party stopped me and visited with me, and it just seemed like a good fit right now for my time of life.
Have you felt supported by the party then to sort of come and learn what needs to...
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so, yes. All through the campaign process, you know, the party was always there giving advice and helping out in any way that they could. I had a good level of support from the Republican Party here in Cottington County.
Give me an idea of what some of your legislative priorities are this first session.
Well, my priorities, you know, I've said before to the media, I'm not going out there with any particular axe to grind. I'm going out there to be an open-minded lawmaker, to take the people's ideas. I'm very open. I'm very, very commonplace and familiar with a lot of people, and I just want to be a good common-sense legislator. I think so many times that's what we kind of lose in the process of having a lot of experience and a lot of time in peer or on a federal level, too, for that matter, that we lose that just real desire to do good lawmaking and listen to the people at all times. Hmm. And that's my intention. While I was on the City Council, I served a couple of my terms as the council president, which gets you a little bit closer to the mayor's office and the decision-making on a local level. I also served on the Planning Commission. I served on the Zoning Commission. I served on Public Works and Finance. So I kind of touched on a little bit of all the things that I'll be doing out in Pierre. I know out in Pierre is going to be a much higher level and a much bigger numbers on everything that you do, but I feel comfortable that I've got the experience it takes.
Do you have committee assignments yet?
I do. I'm on Health and Human Services, and I wanted to be on education, but I didn't get education. But I did get the small city government.
Sure.
That was another one that I really wanted to be on because I felt like I really had things to bring to the table from after having served locally so long.
Sure. Initiated Measure 22. How has that impacted your preparation?
Well, Initiative Measure 22. You know, I think the governor described it quite aptly when he said it was kind of the worst put-together piece of legislature that he's ever seen in his days. And I think the intent of Initiative 22 was probably a good one as far as the South Dakota people were concerned. They seen the words Ethics Commission, which nobody's going to disagree with. They seen the word bribery, which nobody wants to see happen. But you have to remember that initiative came, I think it was 96% funded from out-of-state dollars. Why? That's still a big question mark. But I don't think anybody disagrees, and there really is checks and balances in our state government right now. We just have to bone those up and really enforce them. And as far as bribery, that's always been against the law. And, you know, here in South Dakota, I don't think that's really an issue. If it is, I think we send good people to peer. I think we look around our communities and say, here's a good person that's an honest person and will be a good representative for me. Those are the people we send to peer. Do bad things happen to good people? Uh-huh, sometimes they do. And that's why we do have to have a checks and balances in place to take care of those things before they really snowball into a big deal.
Do you think that legislation can be crafted this session that would satisfy the voter intent?
I do. I think there's some things that can be done. Another thing that was bad for everyone with Initiative 22, it took away that touch with the people. You know, it would make it almost impossible for the legislators to go to the, for instance, the Corn Growers Association Soup Supper. Or the physical therapist chili dinner, whatever the association is, whatever they're putting on for the legislator, that's such a good time for education. You know, a bowl of soup is not a bribery to a legislator, but that's the way it would be interpreted by Initiative 22. Those things we would have not been able to attend. And, you know, to take that contact away, I think is really doing an injustice to the legislators that you send out there. Because, you know, you can Google an organization and find out all sorts of facts and figures, but there's nothing like sitting across the table with a group of farm people that really know what they're talking about, they know what their organization is all about, and they just want to tell you. Hmm. That's education in my thinking, and that's what we'd have been losing. But I think we can take that Initiative 22 apart and make it something that the people really wanted. Because when I talk to the people here in the Watertown area that elected me, they had absolutely no idea what they were voting for.
Hmm.
37 pages, I don't know how many thousands of words were in that bill. Nothing that you know, it wasn't defined for us because, by design, it was from an out-of-state organization that was trying to convince South Dakota of something that we don't believe in.
Have voters expressed that to you, voters who did vote for it? Have they come to
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. There's been so much conversation about Initiative 22. In fact, a lot of the organizations, you know, like I say, South Dakota Corn Growers Association, the beef people, the pork producers, those people all were canceling their events, very sadly, and I don't know how many of them have been rescheduled on the calendar, but we had already gotten notices that we were invited to this or that during the legislative session, and then it was followed up by letters that saying, because of initiated Measure 22, we will not put you in the position of not coming, or so they were just canceling their meetings. So I think people were really disappointed with that, and I hope some of those people have rethought that and will go ahead and bring their education out to us.
What are you looking forward to the most?
What am I looking forward to the most? I think just getting to know the other legislators and really getting in there and helping with bills. I don't have a bill that I'm personally presenting. I've been approached about co-sponsoring with some bills, but I don't have a bill, and not that I don't have some thoughts on some bills, but I just sort of wanted to really get the feel of things and talk to people and just really get to know the whole system while I'm out there. That's what I'm looking forward to. I'm excited for that first gavel to fall and for us to be able to start business.
That's Nancy York. She is from District 5. We reached her in Watertown before the 2017 legislative session began, and that is part of our series of the freshman class of lawmakers for South Dakota headed to Pierre this week. We're going to take a quick break, but first, if you want to connect with us, you can find us on Facebook, also Twitter, Moment at SDPB. That's where I'm at. Email us at inthemoment@sdpb.org, or you can also send us a text, 605-956-SDPB. That's 956-7372, all the ways that you can reach out and connect with us online via email and with the phone. We're going to take a break for news. We'll continue on with another hour of In the Moment. Coming up, the Dakota Political Junkies. We'll talk about the new president-elect's relationship with the media, the governor's State of the State address, and more. We've also got Secretary of the South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks, Kelly Hepler, later in the hour. And out of the ashes of catastrophe, the new advocates of nuclear energy. We preview the Nova special, The Nuclear Option. I'm Lori Walsh. Stay with us in the moment.